Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission. All right, good evening, Chris. Welcome back, everyone listening to the WFO Life Podcast. How are things going tonight, Chris?
Doing good. I thought I would try a change of scenery. We got a rare blast of not humid and pleasant air, so I'm on my back porch. So we'll see if there's some extra ambient noise. We'll say it adds to the character of the program tonight.
Oh, nice! So you're getting some fresh air, not down in the basement.
No, out of the hole, so to speak. So.
very good. Yeah. Well, last week we had talked about a topic we called thinking traps. Basically, there were several we went through, but this time we want to talk about solutions for thinking traps. You think we should review those again, or do you think just have everybody go back and listen to that?
Yeah, I'm going to list them out, and so it'll be somewhat of a teaser to people that haven't listened to the previous episode, but hopefully people are following us in order. So if you haven't listened to the prior episode, I would suggest you go back so you can understand more about the thinking traps. But today we're going to focus on the strategies to hopefully combat those thinking traps that we talked about last time. So I'm going to just list them out and then hopefully, run into some actionable stuff we can do.
Right.
So just a quick review. The five thinking traps are mind reading, me, them, catastrophizing, and helplessness. So hopefully, like I said, if you haven't listened to the prior episode, that'll be a teaser because some of them are self-explanatory. Others not so much. So that's just the quick review of the five thinking traps. So,
yeah. And last time it seemed like when we went through those in detail, it seemed like probably anyone that listens to those probably at one point or another has probably experienced one of them. And so I think that makes this very valuable because we can actually go through and present tools for perhaps unraveling ourselves out of those thinking traps and have more effective thinking, more effective, maybe a more effective communication, all kinds of different things we can do with that.
Yeah, and what I'll do without having to rehash the definitions, I will say especially when we go into the real time, kind of functional strategies, I'll say, hey, this one is probably functional to deal with this thinking trap or two thinking traps, and this next one is with the other two or three, so that way the people following along from the prior episode can say, okay, I know what that is and how I can apply that. So
Roger.
So the first one is evidence is the I guess the title of it. So a thinking trap is essentially something that causes you to go down a rabbit hole of anxiety. And it could be short-term, situational, or it could be, a consistent thing that happens, thinking traps that you always fall into when X happens. But evidence is just saying, it's like positive self-talk. So evidence is being logical and telling yourself, this trap is not true because, and you fill in the blank. So for example, me obviously is the trap. It's it's focused on you. That you're the sole cause of every setback or problem. So
right.
So the evidence based approach would say, well, that's not true because I was able to get into the position I am because I'm very proficient at these things that I'm faced with now. I'm just
right.
having to go back to the well and prove myself again, if that makes sense.
Right. So this is a mental exercise when maybe you're in an anxiety-provoking situation or in a situation where you're using a thought process that seems like a common theme, like something that triggers you over and over and over, right?
Yeah. So, I gave an example. So, blaming yourself for the cause of a predicament, whether it's true or not. And then another way would be catastrophizing, which would be, making an event that could be an isolated thing that's a non-issue into this giant, life-changing threat Right. And it's in you, and I, you know, I use the word several times, ruminating, where you essentially are wasting energy by just going round and round. And a lot of times people say that this is a cause of insomnia, right? Because right. You know, and we'll go into mindfulness later, which helps you to get out of that trap. But basically, if you can take a breath, and these are, we're going to go at the end of the episode tonight into some more, I guess you'd say, long-term habits that can help you to avoid these before they even start. But these are more like functional. Like you think of yourself in the moment. You know, you're going to give a presentation. You know, you have
they're like short-term tools. I mean, it's like a tool that you can say, okay, I'm experiencing this. Let me, what are the facts? You can just ask, what are the facts about this? And you can walk yourself through that like a mental exercise.
Yeah, so to apply the evidence, like that's not true because. So you think about catastrophizing. I think last time we also talked about some triggers. And it's funny, I talked to one of my civilian counterparts today because he joked about a situation where, you know, he got sent a calendar invitation on Outlook. And, you know, that you can look and see who the other invitees are. And it was like a lawyer, an HR person, and like one of the most senior people in our organization. And you're like, and so it's funny. I actually brought up last week's episode and, you know, what we're going to talk about today because I was like, you know, you can be the most mindful, the coolest, the best person at dealing with these thinking traps. But if you get invited to something with no context and it's like a lawyer, an HR person, and like your boss, it's like
you're going to start jumping to conclusions for sure.
Yeah. But the good thing about it is it ended up being a non-issue. So that was another kind of a good example for this episode, right? And so, like, another evidence base, like, hey, you know, you're catastrophizing something, but when you focus on, you know, who you are and what you've been doing, and it's like, okay, I know it can't be a lawyer and HR person for me because there's really nothing that I've done to, you know, warrant having a lawyer and a HR person, you know, hand me my box and tell me to collect my things, right?
Right.
So that's like evidence.
It's a perfect
example. So he kind of gave me an example of that. So evidence is pretty straightforward. You kind of talk yourself off the ledge, so to speak, saying, hey, you know, these things that I'm allowing the situation to tell my mind are not true because, and you can fill in the blank with, you know, things that are, I guess, good about you or, you know, other situations you've been in similarly and you came out, you know, smelling like a rose on the other end. So,
right.
So the next one is reframe. So, straightforward also. For example, like helplessness, you know, that's one that I'm not going to steal any thunder for people going back to the other episode either way. You know, it's straightforward. So that's a trap when you believe that some event you're faced with is going to just derail your whole life. So you're taking an isolated incident and make it like a global all-encompassing event, right? So, so a reframing strategy would be start with a sentence, you know, a more helpful way to see this is. So, for example, especially like right now, you think about the quarantine, the COVID-19 crisis, a lot of people have either lost their job or had a pay cut or, you know, been forced to stay at home and, you know, maybe especially if you're like in a commission-based outside sales, it's a little bit more difficult to engage with clients, you know, things like that. So, you know, a more helpful way to see that would be, well, you know, at least I have resources that the government has provided me to, you know, tide me over until, you know, things get back to normal. Or a more helpful way to see this is I'm able to spend more time with my family and build on these relationships that will be with me forever, you know, whereas, you know, unless you own your own business or some other, you know, fill in the blank cases, most jobs are not forever anyway. You know, I mean, you go through a series of, even if you're an entrepreneur, I mean, you know, you may have different businesses, you may repackage things and, you know, change the focus of your business. So that's an extreme, I mean, that's like probably a common thing that happens that, can give you that feeling of helplessness, and it's like a true thinking trap that can, you know, have a global impact. But it, you can still, you know, take a breath and say, hey, a more helpful way to see this is, you know, the examples that I just gave.
I was thinking about, you could also use reframe to ask a question. So for instance, while you were describing that, I was thinking, well, another, say you have a setback, and or you have a thought that's running through your head, something that perhaps you're seeing in a negative light or excessive negativity, that type of thing. You could also kind of reframe, like ask a question, what can I learn from this? Or where's the opportunity in this setback? You know, it's kind of a way of reframing something, so it's not the end of the world if something negative happens, or if some, because most of the time this comes up, I think, when somebody has a setback, I guess is what I'm imagining, and then they think, oh, it's ruined everything in my life, you know, that kind of thing, and I can't change anything about it. It's gonna have this cascading effect. Well, you could also ask, you know, how can I grow from this? Where's the opportunity? There's you could flip that, reframe it, and it kind of changes your mind. When I say something like that, even if I have a bad setback with something, I can imagine if my first question in my head was, what can I learn from this? That sort of automatically diffuses that sense of helplessness, because it's kind of a built-in, well, assumption that, well, now I'm going to be moving forward because I've learned something. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think it's, you know, like going back to some other interviews and things we've done, there's always optimistic and pessimistic ways to see it. And, right. You know, some of us, like we mentioned, I think last week, you know, in a lot of cases, there's environmental things or, you know, even genetics involved. Like you're maybe born or environmentally you're a certain way. But, you know, as you get older and you want to improve yourself, you have to force yourself. And even like the professor who taught this class that's kind of that I'm basing this series of podcasts on, she was saying, hey, you know, even though I teach this and I'm a big proponent of positive psychology, I know this, and, you know, I've clinically defined myself as a more pessimistic person, which is kind of ironic that she's, you know, a proponent and teaching classes on it. But that's a good example, right? You can, you know, as humans, you know, we're given this power of reason and these complex functioning brains that we can say, hey, even though I know I'm like this, I can situationally choose to, you know, not react a certain way. So it's a powerful thing.
You know, even on that note, though, you know, I think I'm a little bit that way. Sometimes I could probably be on the pessimistic side on certain things. But one of the things that also, for some people, it's a normal operating mode. Like, I'm one of those people, you know, you have people you can sit in a room with and you can throw out ideas, right? Like idea people, and it just anything is imaginable. So I'm kind of one of those types that if I have a project, I can tend to look and kick the tire, so to speak, and figure out what's wrong with a problem. You know, it may be prior to my medical training where I sort of go through and kind of look for problems. Does that make sense? And
yeah.
And I think that, you know, that sometimes pessimism doesn't have to be, it's not, I don't think it's a great, you know, thing to live your whole life by, but at the same time, if you understand that's how you work, that's how you're thinking, your base tendency, well, then you can reframe, you can use reframing tools to get you out of what really is sometimes an inappropriate thinking trap in itself.
Yeah, and the end of what you were saying there about kind of falling into an inappropriate line of thinking, the problem with that is it tends to trigger an emotional response.
Right.
And like we talked about before, that emotional response, your brain, your physiology cannot always like differentiate on what's real and what's a perceived. And so what happens is if you go down that line of thinking, which triggers emotions, which triggers your physiological response, well, now you're going to be in the throes of, you know, adrenal problems and,
right,
you know, hormonal responses. And
stress response.
And, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so that becomes, you can still combat that. Like even if you feel yourself, you know, getting the heart palpitations, you know, the sweaty palms, you know, your little tightness in your chest and breathing a little quicker, you can still, you know, use these strategies to help turn the tide. And, you know, and one of the things they recommend is, you know, a breathing practice. There's lots of different things, and it's the breathing and the focusing on the breath does two things. You know, it puts you in a mindful state where you're not focusing on, you know, what's giving you that response, and it calms down your physiology. You know, you're infusing, you know, oxygen in a calm mindset to try to combat it. So just because you start to, you know, go down that physiological response, and I've done this myself, both on physical event situations and just like, you know, mental event situations, given presentations, you know, I felt myself, and I think we all have, and sometimes you go down, you know, the rabbit hole and you're like, crap, I guess I'm going to be here in a cold sweat, you know, looking like a jackass trying to, you know, building a mental and physical callus there, because you're like, right. You know, most of the time you're not going to drop and take a header, you know, I mean, then, you know, you got other problems, but you know, it might not be the best presentation you've ever given, but you'll get through it. And then right. You'll say, okay, you know, and that puts you in a different mindset. You're like, hey, I can never let that happen again. You know, maybe, I wasn't as prepared as I should have been or what have you. So,
right.
So
you actually threw out there a breathing technique as a tool, to some extent as well. I often recommend to patients that I see that are suffering with anxiousness or sort of runaway mood, you know, mindset type things, I'll actually tell them to do what's called box breathing. And that's where essentially, and you want to do this, imagine, I'll kind of talk through it, but you inhale, imagine inhaling through your nose for about a count of four. So 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4, 1,000. That's in through your nose. Then you hold your breath for a count of four. Imagine you're completing another angle on a box. You're holding the breath, and then you exhale through the nose as well, okay? Down, mm-hmm. And then at the base, you hold the breath again, and it completes a square. So it's in through the nose, hold the breath, back down, and then hold the breath at the base. So you could do that for a count of three to four, and just continuously do that. That has actually been shown when you breathe through the nose, that actually calms and turns on the parasympathetic nervous system, which is opposite of the fight or flight system. I think I've read somewhere, maybe you know more about this, but I read that I think Special Forces guys, Navy SEAL kind of folks, I think they use that for what they call arousal control. So if they're in some very, you know, life-threatening situation, they'll start doing what's called box breathing. They're trained to control their breathing by breathing through the nose, sometimes out through the mouth, but breathing through the nose in particular turns off that fight or flight. You know, if you can imagine, if you were in a fight or flight situation, you're panting and you're breathing through your mouth. That's an anxiety provoking, you know, situation to a pattern to of breath. And there's lots of martial arts that talk about breath control as a means for, you know, focusing the mind and calming the body, mastering the body, that type of thing. So it's kind of cool that you brought that up. Was that one that you were, is the breathing technique, is that actually one of the strategies for mind traps, or just, you just threw that in?
Yeah, so, I mean, that is more in a long-term, it can be a real-time strategy. The way that, you know, I learned it in this course is more of a, you know, these are just ways to do business, so to speak, you know, ways to prepare, you know, ways to, you know, practice mindfulness. You know, they talked about breathing techniques as, you know, kind of a part of a meditation practice.
Right.
And we'll get into a little bit more, but I think the last real time strategy that I wanted to cover is just called plan. And I think it works best on some of those more, you know, the catastrophic and the helpless, you know, situations. So, and a lot of times, like this one gets into the, I guess, more deliberate planning, but you can do it on the fly too. So you say, if X happens, I will Y. So this is saying, this is almost also turning on that logical portion of you as a human, saying if you're going to catastrophize, when you have a plan that, you know, if this happens and it is down the catastrophe road, or, you know, I'm in a helpless situation, I'm at least going to have a plan to do Y. And so, you know, as human animals and as sometimes emotional beings, that gives you some sense of control. And this reminds me of the Stoic philosophy, where it's like, hey, you can't control situations. You know, you can war game a little bit and try to, you know, decide what you think might happen. But having a plan is better than having no plan at all, because then you feel like a leaf in the wind. And in this case, you know, so good.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, so if you imagine if you were a student or you're at work and you're giving a presentation, you know, sometimes people have quite a bit of anxiousness or anxiety about that, right or wrong. You know, that presentation anxiety, that social anxiety is pretty common for a lot of people. So this would be a situation where you could say to yourself, okay, I'm really anxious about this. I sense that I'm really keyed up. I'll keep my notes. And if I lose my train of thought, because I'm afraid I'm going to lose my train of thought, if you lose your train of thought, then my action will be to remember to just check where I was in my notes, you know, that type of thing. Just refer back to my notes and just keep a bulletin of notes. So it's a way to say, you know, you can walk yourself through, I'm getting anxious about this presentation, but if I do feel like I get off track, if I feel like I'm getting, I get lost in my thought, then I can just jump in and use my note, and that'll reset myself. You know, you can tell your, is that kind of the same thing you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking when you mentioned that, I didn't have it in my notes for tonight, but I know me personally, you know, I'm a conversational type presenter. Like, you know, some people try to do the traditional college professor, you know, or traditional presenter type situation where, like, hey, I know exactly what I'm going to say, you know, on this slide or for this point. And you may have like detailed notes almost word for word, even though you don't try to read them, like you have it exactly what you're going to say. And some people, like, that's how they have a comfort zone to right. get to present. For me, if I do that, I come across too robotic. You know, I can be, just the way my voice is anyway, it's a little baritone. And so it can right. like lull people to sleep and be a little robotic. But you know, I've been told that I have a good personality and I'm engaging and, you know, I do like people. And so what I try to do is I have a script, but I try to know the material well enough where I can turn it into a conversation. Even if I'm, you know, talking 95% of the time, I tend to like to walk around the room because I know for me it keeps people's attention instead of standing at the podium. Even if there is a podium, I tend to like stand on the opposite side of the room from the podium.
Right.
So I do. I think for me, it's just I try to find ways to engage with the audience, and you know, and that's one technique that I have. And so, but my fallback plan is if I get fumbled up on my words or if I get stressed out, I have the script there that I know, and I tend to have, like, you know, bolded and italicized and highlighted so that it makes certain things stick out. So if I get tongue-tied or if I'm fumbling my words, I can glance down and be able to see the bolded word of the topic that I'm on, and then I just start reading the script. And so that's kind of my, like, if X happens, then Y. You know, hopefully I don't have to do that, but I have a backup plan so I don't, you know.
I can imagine that people can still really get wrangled up into a mind trap where they might have this whole list of, you know, if X happens, then I'm going to do Y. They may have this whole, but maybe there is some value for some people to go through that mental exercise. To say, hey, look, you know, these are the big things that I'm worried about for this presentation or this situation. If these 1, 2, 3 things happen, then I will react with XYZ, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah, I think
there's,
you know,
still a danger of going too far down that road where you're just like every minutia point. You got to be careful to step back from that, you know, take a big, broad perspective of any situation you're facing.
Yeah, and I think we just used a maybe lower level, you know, common, you know, catastrophe, I guess you will, but it probably works even better when you're talking about some of these, you know, more life-changing events.
Like complex work situations. Like, I'm concerned about my boss doing XYZ, so if this were to happen, these are the 2 or 3 probable things that could happen. I might not get the sale, I might get the sale, I might, you know, or, you know, whatever that kind of thing is. And then you could go through and say, okay, well, then I'll have a plan for each of those possible scenarios, how I might react to that. I know that's how you would do negotiation. I've read, you know, a lot about, you know, negotiation styles. If you got to go in with what you want, then you can kind of negotiate from this place of what you really want, but then you can have a series of scenarios that might play out depending on what you think the other person might want. And that's a kind of another version of this where you go in a little more planned. It might take away some of that anxiousness you might have or about the possible conflict of a negotiation, if you will.
Yeah, you know, and going on along the lines of what you're saying, like if it's a, you know, higher level stressful negotiation, you can always have like a default position, like, hey, we're going to go for the moon. You know, we're going to try to sell them X, Y, and Z. But if they, you know, if they're not having that, you know, we know that they've proven to like, you know, this strategy or this product. And so, you know, we want to give them, you know, the whole package. We want to sell them the product and the services to go with it that we provide. But at the end of the day, we can say, hey, we know you like the product. We know that there's other people that can provide, you know, services to go along with said product. So, you know, that's kind of the backup position. You know, that's the comfortable position where you come out with a sale, you come out with a positive outcome, but you're not maybe, you know, coming out with the moon and the stars like you hope for. Right.
Excellent. So, yeah, that makes sense.
So those are three common, you know, resilience strategies, I guess you'd say, to combat the thinking traps, you know, evidence, reframe the situation and have a plan. So I think now I want to transition into, I guess, more of a lifestyle. I guess I'll say it like that, where,
okay,
you know, we all know that we're going to have, you know, situations, these traps or things in life that come up that can create anxieties that derail us from being, you know, the best that we can be and, you know, take a bite out of our resilience. So one of the most proven and long-term strategies to prevent or cope with this is just the act and I guess you'd say the practice of mindfulness. And there's different ways that people, you know, practice mindfulness. And, you know, one of the most common, I guess, synonyms with mindfulness is meditation.
Right.
So I know going back, probably my early adulthood, there's a negative connotation to that, right? Because you have this, you see in movies where, you know, the people are chanting in, you know, airports and, you know,
right,
prayer circles and
right,
things like that. But it can be a lot of things, right? And so I think we've already, you know, alluded to one, which is breathing. You know, that can be the beginning of a mindful practice or a meditation
right,
practice. So
it's actually a good way to start it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think you know, some of the bigger podcasters that we've referenced on this podcast that you know, have a lot of successful business people, successful people almost in every area of life, you know, or I guess every you know, medium, if you will, politics, actors and actresses, athletes. One of the common denominators is that most of them have some type of, you know, practice in meditation.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah. So, and the duration thing is what throws people off, because you hear about these, you know, silent retreats where, you know, there's mindful practice and meditation practices that, you know, where nobody talks for 24 hours. And you're like, oh, my God, you know, that seems superhuman. That's going to drive me crazy, because some people don't want to be alone with their own thoughts for 5 minutes when they're trying to go to sleep, you know, which creates like right, insomnia. But anyway, but really, and it's hard to understand until you, you know, maybe go through the psychology and some of the science behind it. But really all that meditation or mindfulness does is it takes, I guess you'd say, a part of your mind that notices something, like your attention, and it focuses the attention on something, something else. And usually it's something generic, something vanilla, something bland, because when you're able to focus your mind on your breath, or, you know, there's religious mindfulness practices where it's so all of it is focusing on something other than all of your thoughts. It's bringing attention to something that's available, whether that be your breath or something. I mentioned like a religious practice. You might focus on a picture of a saint, a cross, you know, some type of relic. So, you know, it can be visual. It can be sound. You know, some people use music.
Yeah, like sound would be like a lot of the Eastern meditative practices. They believe certain sounds have certain, you know, certain harmonics like and things like that. Some of those types of things are supposed to have healing properties to them or help you focus the mind in a different way. There's also something else about meditation. There's a temporal component to it. In other words, I think when you're meditating, one of the things that's very important, and I know I've already mentioned this all the time, is the idea of being in the present moment. Is also, you know, time sort of slows down whenever you start focusing on a granular, if you're staring at a candle flame and that's the only moment in time, you're not daydreaming about something in the future, back in the past, you're temporally bringing your mind to the exact present moment. That's another big component of meditation.
Yeah, and I think that what we just covered should be empowering to people. I know it was for me, because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. You know, it can be a prayer, it can be chanting, it can be an image, it can be music. You know, what matters the most is that it prevents your mind from, you know, jumping around, and it has a stable, I guess you'd say, resting place where you, and then over time you get better. And you could become more capable at resting your mind in that way. And I think that's a good way to put it. And I've read it in several places. You know, we change the way that our attention span works. And then we're able to focus our attention. And then and it really just brings stability. And right. I know for me, I have, you know, I guess it's hard to say non-traditional, because, you know, we just listed a lot of ways that you can become more mindful and do that. But I know for me, some of it has to do with routine. And I think I laid out what my perfect day would start out like. And it is a type of mindful practice and a meditation, if you will. But for me, it has to do with the sequence. And I think the sequence of things helps me to get in that state, you know. And some people say it's setting them up for what would be called a flow state, and obviously that's the, you know, the best case scenario where, right, you know, mentally, physically, emotionally, you set all the conditions, you know, to put yourself in that state where you can work well, where you can perform well. But I know for me, like I said, part of it is a spiritual thing, part of it is you know, reflecting on Stoic philosophy and being in a quiet place. And so
you're talking about like your morning routine, right? Like,
So, I mean,
the same routine every morning becomes almost a ritual or meditative practice for you.
Yeah, that's my mindful state. And, you know, and I'm not as consistent about it, or I haven't been now that I'm working from home, because I was good about, I would use my arrival to my workspace as a way to get in that state, you know. And I had a couple books, you know, I had my, I should say my religious piece of it. I had my Stoic philosophy piece of it. And then I had, you know, being in a quiet space. And so those three things helped me to focus and get my mind out of its own way and kind of, you know, build that stability. If that makes sense. So.
It does. I'm glad you mentioned flow state, because that's something I did a course a while back, I guess you call it a mastermind group with a guy named Eric Davis, a former Navy SEAL. He's got a great topic that he does, and it's a big theme of the material he puts out, where he talks about flow state, and it's this ultra creative, ultra productive state, and there's different ways to achieve flow state. And I would really love to go through that with him. I've been loosely back and forth communicating a little bit, trying to get him on the show. That would be an excellent topic to run down at some point, because flow state is sort of a meditative state. I mean, it's kind of like when you go for a run and you get into the middle of a really, really long run, you can get to this place where you're just sort of flowing along. The mind is quiet. You know, the body's humming along, it's doing its thing, and that is a flow state. It's a form of meditation, quite frankly.
And like I said, I think hopefully we're giving people hope that it's not, you know, weird people with the half-shaved heads at the airport trying to hand you a prayer book. You know, that doesn't have to be your guide to meditation, right?
Yeah, there are certainly spiritual practices that use meditation. I mean, prayer is a form of meditation to some extent. But there's a ton of other, I mean, just breathing techniques and quieting the mind. And, you know, I look at the mind as there's two parts to it in my mind. I believe that there is sort of the monkey mind that's sort of just on, you know, just reacting to the world. And then there's our higher self. And I think that's the more you meditate. And I'm going to put an asterisk next to this. I am not an experienced meditator. I'm a complete novice. But I have done meditation consistently over time, and there's been a few times in probably the last 9 to 12 months here recently where I actually said, okay, I'm going to meditate longer and longer on a regular basis, like working out basically. It becomes like working out. It's just part of your routine. And the longer I go, the more interesting my mind behaves and let's call it clear my thoughts are, and the purpose behind my thoughts are much more clear. Whereas if I get, like right now, I would say I'm not in the habit of meditating. I'm in the habit of running right now, so I do a lot of, you know, meditating that way. But I'm the quiet sitting, breathing, and saying I'm not going to do anything for the next 30 to 45 minutes. I worked up to one point to that, and when I was doing that regularly, it was amazing at how thoughtful and quiet my mind was. I remember thinking everything around me seemed to move a little slower, meaning I could see what was happening before it was upon me. Whereas when I don't do it, I feel like I'm bumping into the walls. I feel like I'm just sort of, you know, and there may be people listening that hear this and think, yeah, I get like that. I just feel like I'm reacting to the world, you know, and just bumping into things and reacting to whatever life throws at me. Well, the reality is when you quiet your mind, you start to get more insight into why you do things to begin with. You start to get these different insights into why your mind is doing it. And you then begin to observe your own mind. And then you start to observe like I said, the monkey mind. And you start to say, look, he's freaking out over that situation again that always comes up. And he always reacts the same way. I think I choose not to do that today. And that's what I got to with my novice level, you know, beginner meditation practice. It is something that I think there's a lot of people that could benefit from. And when I've recommended this to patients and they say, oh, I can't do that, my mind can't stay, I think those are the people that need that the most.
Well, I was going to say, everything that you used to find about your own experience with it, I guess by definition, everything that you described and the way that your mind behaved is that it became more reliable to you on the way it was going to react and behave in all different types of situations, right?
Yes, and you could anticipate it's like you could see the traps coming, if you will.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, bringing it back to our whole thinking trap solutions. I thought my experience with meditation has been that I was able to see what my mind was reacting to in a way that was like, I could see it in the future. It was like, oh, this is going to happen. This is probably going to be anxiety provoking for me in this particular situation or this source of conflict or whatever.
This happens all the time and I don't react like this. So that's saying more about you than it is that other person or the situation. And I know I try to teach my kids this. I was like, if somebody bites your heads off, you know, in a benign situation, that says more about them than it does about you, you know?
Right.
So I think that the more you can practice mindfulness, like we were talking about, your mind is more stable, it's more reliable. So if you do have stressful situations, or if you are in a depleted state, you know, sometimes if you're tired, if you're sick, you know, especially if you have something that's kind of a common thing, but like if you have a sinus headache, right, or something like that, where it's like hard to think because, you know, you have pressure around your eyes and forehead, you're like, okay, I know that I'm going to have problems focusing and reacting to it, that might be a day or a time that you have to even be more mindful and, you know, and set yourself up for say, hey, I'm going to have to deal with these situations, and, you know, you're going to stable your mind. You're going to, you know, make your mind more reliable before that situation happens. And that's what mindfulness or practice of meditation and mindfulness does for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just like exercise, I think people should play with that a little bit. I know I'm a big believer. And in fact, just talking about this again has got me in a mode of I'm just going to add it to my routine every day. It's been, you know, I have my quiet time in the morning, kind of like you, the morning ritual, if you will. And then exercise is a big, you know, capper to the morning ritual. I think I'm going to go ahead and add that back in and kind of start bumping up my minutes there so that I'm spending time before the day really gets going, you know, quieting things down, getting focused. I like this topic. Just the whole mental trap idea was eye-opening for a lot of people, and a lot of people downloaded this last episode. And I think having some practical kind of psychological tools or thinking tools you can use, the evidence, the reframing, I think were great. Planning, you know, if you're in a bad situation or you're getting, you know, kind of thoughts that are triggering anxiety, you know, so having a plan, like if X happens, then Y. And lastly, the tool of mindfulness. And I think these are great reminders, and really, really glad you brought this up. Got any final thoughts tonight?
I'm going to have a teaser because I think this could, you know, open up almost another series. And, you know, we've talked about categorizing these things, and maybe at some point developing a class through the Future Focus Health Network and the WFO Live Podcast Tribe. So I think that this, the last thought I'll have on this tonight is there is a, I guess, a body of evidence that shows if you can identify your own personal character strengths and figure out how to use those strengths, that's another way that you can build resilience and deal with anxiety. So what I'll probably do in the post for this episode is I'll put a link to a survey that you can, it's free, and it has like a really good analysis of your character strengths. And you can always tell if a survey is worth a dang sometimes by, you know, how many different ways it's asking the same types of questions. So I think that this will be great because the character strengths identification will be something fun that we can kind of do as a community. And then we can probably have a couple episodes on like, hey, you know, how you use your top character strengths, and even, you know, the counter, there's like a shadow side to character strengths, which is kind of cool to think about. So it's like point, counterpoint, pro and con. It's like, hey, you know, now that I know my top strengths, like, for example, one of my top strengths is, no surprise here, love of learning. Right. So the shadow side of that strength. So there's a lot of good ways to help other people and to use that strength to develop yourself. But the shadow side or the negative side can be if you're like that and that's like one of their bottom character strengths, it's like way down the list, then you're going to drive them crazy because they'll be like, you know, I only learn the things I have to for my job, and I, you know, like to, you know, learn, but it's not like a top priority for me and I don't gravitate to it. So if you're always talking about, hey, you know, did you read that new book I told you about? Did you listen to that podcast? You know, people like me and you would probably drive people crazy if like love of learning was like, right. You know, it's like, you know, there's 24 character strengths that are kind of commonly understood. If it's number 24 for them and it's number 2 for you, right. You know, that's like oil and water. So, right, I mean, there is a negative side. So character strengths, by identifying them and being able to put those into practice, that's another way to just kind of build your resilience because you're playing to your strengths, you know, not always you're just focusing on how to develop your weaknesses, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, it does. I can see where you're going with that. That would be a great topic for the next few weeks here. I know we do have some interviews coming up. I guess we'll leave those as a surprise. I've been working on trying to land a few. I know you've got a couple on the pipeline. So we've done a few kind of different sort of philosophical, psychological, you know, type programs here lately, but we're going to jump back into some interviews in the coming weeks. But I think what you just mentioned will be a great one for an upcoming show.
Yep, that's really all I have for tonight.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Yep.
And we'll close out.
Sounds good. Out.